Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, both Fresno and Bakersfield are turning to new laws to deal with the problem of homelessness. We'll find out what these new restrictions mean for those living on the streets. We'll also talk about the effort to unionize college athletes. That effort got a big boost last week when students at Northwestern University won the right to organize. Does this mean that universities should pay student athletes as employees? We'll talk with Mara Korzowski of the Fresno Bee. And we'll get a preview of this weekend's Fresno Philharmonic concert featuring a guest artist playing an instrument you've likely never heard before, called the pipa. That's all coming up in just a moment, so stay with us. But first, our series Voices of the Drought continues with a visit to the source of most of our water, the High Sierra. Traditionally, the April 1st snow survey marks the peak of the year's snowpack. And this year, a series of late-season storms, like last night's, have given the mountains a little extra moisture. Over the past few days, snow surveyors have been busy collecting data on the snowpack. Our Ezra David Romero tagged along with one crew and brings us this report.
At 6,000 feet, Christine Borman, our pilot, and I hop out of a helicopter into a snow-laden meadow below Courtright Reservoir in the Sierra National Forest. Borman is a Pacific Gas and Electric hydrographer and is part of a network of snow surveyors tallying water content in the Sierra Nevada. We're on one of the last snow survey flights of the season, measuring the meager snowpack in the Kings River watershed.
How's it feel out there?
Actually kind of warm for snow.
The data collected in this survey will be used by PG&E and others to estimate just how much snowmelt we can expect this spring. Even in a normal year, it's an important job. But in a drought like this one, she says these measurements are even more critical.
This year we have a dry year, just like we have for the past 2 years. Last wet year was in 2011. So the accumulation of three dry years means that there wasn't much water storage from the previous year, not much carryover.
As we hike from the helicopter to the first survey site, our snowshoes crunch over the snowpack that will soon feed into the reservoirs like Courtright and Wishon for energy production. The water will eventually flow into the Kings River and down into the San Joaquin Valley, supplying water to farms and cities like Fresno. Snow surveys like this go back decades.
We take a look at the map. This course was established in 1928. And the idea of the snow course is that you want to have repetitive data. So we have this tree that has an orange sign.
Borman assigns me the task of recording the survey data, while our pilot measures the distance between survey spots.
Okay, so what I'm doing is lining myself up with the aerial marker and the orange sign. I'm trying to get myself on the invisible line between the two points.
She then pierces the snow with a hollow aluminum tube that can expand to over 14 feet.
And this seems pretty soft, so I'm going to let it go down pretty easily. I want to be able to get a little piece of dirt or grass to know that I hit bottom instead of an ice layer. This is kind of a marshy creek area, so that's why you see all this water dripping from it. It means that underneath of the snow is melting.
Borman weighs the snow tube and compares its weight to its empty state.
49, so 8 inches of water content.
From our first survey point, we traveled to another meadow at 9,000 feet. But the weather takes a turn for the worse.
Looks like we're getting snowed in and getting heavier clouds coming in, so we're going to be safe and get out of here.
Borman's monthly readings help PG&E decide how much water they should release from reservoirs, how much hydropower the company can produce, and how the watershed she measures will contribute to the statewide snowpack.
We have a lot less water than we normally would, normal being an average of about 50 years. So we're about 20% of normal. So we do have to watch what we do with the water.
That's on par with previous drought years. She also says by looking at how agencies use water in past droughts, we can learn how to best utilize the little water we have.
76, 77 was a dry year as well. As far as I know, PG&E was out doing snow surveys that time too and was able to manage the water going into the reservoirs and still have enough water to meet the demands of customers.
Borman says that while surveys like this one show there may be enough water for PG&E's purposes this year, only time will tell if Valley farms and cities will be as fortunate. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And you can see photos from Ezra's trip on our website online at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. Homelessness is a big problem facing cities large and small throughout Central California. You'll find it in urban areas, in rural settings, in rich neighborhoods, and in poor ones. Two Valley cities, Fresno and Bakersfield, have recently turned to new laws to deal with the related issues surrounding homelessness. Business groups and others say these new laws are needed to keep the public safe and to restore order. But others say they're prompting some to ask whether we're criminalizing homelessness. Here to talk about some of these issues, we're joined with two guests. On the phone, Theo Douglas, a reporter with the Bakersfield Californian, and in our studio, Clint Olivier, who represents District 7 on the Fresno City Council. Clint, I want to start with you. The city just recently passed some new legislation in regards to shopping carts. What does this law prohibit, and exactly why was it needed?
Well, thank you very much for having me on this morning. It was needed in response, really, to the proliferation of shopping carts and homeless in our neighborhoods. I think that the solution is going to require a compassionate solution. However, homeowners and my constituents have really had it up to their eyeballs with the problems that go along with the proliferation of homelessness. As an example, basically, I think the crux of it all is the recycling. Recycling is where many, many homeless get money to eat, to drink, to use, what have you. And so they use shopping carts to bring their recyclables to recycle centers, which are also located in neighborhoods behind grocery stores and convenience stores as per state law. So really, the city council of the city of Fresno is talking about and is actually going after these shopping carts as a way to try and stem the homeless activity in the neighborhoods.
So what exactly is going to happen as this takes effect here, as I understand it, in just a few days? Fresno PD has a lot of things on their plate. We all know about the challenges facing the jail. Are you having Fresno PD officers going around and arresting people who they find with shopping carts? How does this work?
No, because it would be unenforceable. There's nothing that police are stretched thin enough. There are times when people are burglarized and they have their automobiles stolen and the police are unable
exactly.
to show up.
So what happens with this new law?
Basically, this puts a lot of pressure on the owners of the carts to go out and get them when they're abandoned.
Okay. And so the grocery store, the store that actually is legitimate owner of the cart.
Yes, and it's unlawful to possess a cart with a permanently affixed sign on it, and that becomes that goes into law. It's illegal to remove a cart from the business premises of a retail or commercial establishment, to be in possession of any cart, to leave or abandon a cart at a location other than the business premises. But again, without the resources to enforce this, the city is asking and also by ordinance requiring the owners of the carts, the retail shops, to participate in programs to bring those carts back to the store where they belong. Also, we have these major recycling centers. Want to differentiate between the two different kinds of recycle center. There are the neighborhood express recycle centers that you can find behind stores, which is basically a container box and a bunch of trash cans. And these are convenience zones, we'll call them. And then we have the major recycling centers where people can bring copper wire and people can bring pieces of scrap metal. The recycle centers oftentimes are faced with dozens of these carts at the end of the day. They have to make sure those get back as well.
Very interesting, and we'll talk about some of the challenges here in a moment, but I want to bring in Theo Douglas, who is a reporter with the Bakersfield Californian. He has been following this story in Kern County and what the city of Bakersfield is trying to do. Theo, this effort to enact legislation that would, in effect, ban panhandling or at least some forms of panhandling has been several months coming, in fact, over 6 months that this has been going around. Exactly how did this come about, and where do we stand right now with this law that's before the city council here in a few weeks?
Well, first of all, good morning, and thanks for having me on the show. And you're correct. This is an issue which has been at least several months in the making. Folks who work in social services here feel like concentration of folks who appear to be homeless in central Bakersfield may be at least partially driven by efforts to clamp down on homeless encampments in and around the Kern River area. This is an issue which we saw come to official bodies earlier this year. A mother whose son, she believes, is a panhandler, wrote a letter which was published in the Californian, and that letter urged folks not to give to panhandlers, on the chance that their money would be used for the wrong things. Inspired by this, folks in the business community late last year asked the city to consider enacting an ordinance that would ban panhandling. That ordinance was given its first reading earlier in March and would return for a second reading and potential adoption on April 16th before the Bakersfield City Council. At least that's my understanding. It's possible the ordinance could be delayed, but April 16th is certainly the next council meeting. And this ordinance would make aggressive solicitation a misdemeanor or an infraction, depending on the exact nature of the violation. And more significantly, it would ban all soliciting near banks, credit unions, ATMs, in parking lots and parking structures after dark, and on road medians and on public transit vehicles. And as I say, this was something that started with a city council committee earlier this year and was given first reading on March 19th. So that's essentially where we're at.
Yeah. Now, Theo, you've been following this issue closely. I asked Clint in Fresno about the issue of enforcement. How is
Yes.
Bakersfield talking about enforcing this? Are there going to be panhandling cops that are going around and citing people and looking for panhandlers? What's the process? What is the city's vision for how this would work in real life?
Good question. My understanding is that there would not be a specific panhandling squad or perhaps a specific Bakersfield Police Department officers dedicated to panhandling. The city attorney said at the last council meeting, that was March 19th, she said, in terms of the impact on enforcement, this is going to remain a low-priority call. The law requires, she said, that a crime occur in the presence of a police officer. And this is something that Police Chief Greg Williamson has also said, this is going to be a crime that will be a relatively low priority. I think everyone here is very mindful of the current impacts which our court and our legal systems face. And so I think Mr. Olivier used phrase, kind of compassionate enforcement. I think that's something which folks in Bakersfield remain very mindful of. I think if there's the opportunity for BPD officers or other entities to connect folks in need with social services, they certainly will do that. And this is something which is going to have to be observed by a Bakersfield police officer to be cited.
Now, Clint, turning back to you, Theo mentioned that in Bakersfield, maybe some of the issues that the city is dealing with there came from the dispersal of homeless encampments along the Kern River. The
yes.
city of Fresno has...
Sounds familiar.
Yes, that does sound familiar with the homeless encampments in the downtown area that were dispersed, removed, demolished by the city late last year. And do you see that similar sort of thing happening in Fresno as those folks who were in those encampments are throughout the rest of the city now?
I do. I see it. I mean, of course, the city of Fresno kind of begins in the south, and it grew differently than many cities, which grew in a circular
yeah.
pattern. This one grew north. So obviously, the next neighborhoods to go to are the ones north of downtown, and those are the ones I represent. Of course, I'm in the middle of a reelection campaign right now, and when you are, you find yourself doing a lot of walking through neighborhoods. And not only do you see it, but you hear complaints from the constituents who and it's really a fact of life in not just South Fresno or Central Fresno, but all over this city, the 34th largest city in the United States, all over. People wake up in the early morning to hear someone going through their recycle bins, which are placed on the curb. And it seems like many of the homeless population know when the bins are going to be out on the curbs. And so then they're rummaging through. I think that for the most part, people kind of take a, well, you know, that's the way it is approach. I don't encounter many people who go running out with a, you know, with a broomstick to chase people away. I think that for the most part, people realize that it's still a tough economy. People realize that these folks are hurting. And again, I think compassion prevails for the most part, and they just let them go through the recycle bins. But of course, then the neighborhood recycling centers become magnets for these folks when they go to turn in the stuff, and then there are problems at that point.
Now, in both Fresno and Bakersfield and throughout the valley, we also hear, in response to these efforts to pass new laws to better regulate the situation or to crack down on some of these activities, homeless advocates say what you're doing is not helping people. You're criminalizing homelessness, and these people are in this situation. They need help. They don't need a ticket that they can't afford to pay. How do you respond to that? You're talking about we need a compassionate response. At the same time, we have a new law here. Will this actually solve something?
I think that the shopping cart ordinance is just one ingredient in many things that need to be done, and passing laws is not the answer to it. It's going to take again the homeless advocates at the table. It's going to take the folks at the Rescue Mission and the Poverello House. Those are our two major homeless service headquarters in the city of Fresno. It's going to take the city council and the police department and the churches. I mean, passing a law is not a silver bullet for anything. Passing a law just says, well, here's more paperwork. But if the law works, if we can get store owners to participate in these cart return programs and to go out and get their carts and to I'm not talking about dumping carts over that belong to homeless people, but if they keep track of their carts and the city does its part to protect business owners and people from aggressive panhandling and the churches and the nonprofits do their part, I think we can see an alleviation, a major alleviating this problem. It's never going to go away.
There's some news stores. I went to one not that long ago that has a system attached to their shopping carts where if you wheel the cart past a certain invisible line in the parking lot, the wheels of the cart lock. Is that something that the city is looking at maybe implementing mandates that stores implement those sorts of technologies? Or
not at this time. There's been some discussion of it. Some stores do it and others do not, and there's no legal requirement for them to have that service at this point. But again, you know, the homeless advocates will say these carts, they're the vehicle, the transportation, they're the life.
Yeah, and not just recycling items, but many of everything they own.
Absolutely. And they say, you know, have some compassion. Let's not have our police go out dumping these carts over. And then we have people in the neighborhoods, homeowners, original owners who've been there for 50 years, who've seen their neighborhoods, the quality of life in their neighborhoods going down because there's people throwing trash, there's people urinating and defecating, and they say, take these carts away, this is stolen property, take these carts away from these folks and send them to jail. Well, we know the jail, you can't, there are people in for greater crimes that we have to let go. And so the answer is not, and I remember I was in here talking about prostitution, human trafficking, and again, the answer has to be, you can't just go out and ticket and arrest people. There has to be other solutions, and that's where nonprofits and the churches have to step up, and I think they are.
Turning back to Theo Douglas with the Bakersfield Californian, who joins us on the phone now. Theo, you had a very interesting letter to the Ask the Bakersfield Californian column recently from someone who was cited by the Bakersfield PD for panhandling and was surprised because this new law had not yet been in place. Tell me about that. And as I understand, there's already a law on the books that authorities can use?
Well, you're correct. And first, however, I'd like to say to Mr. Olivier that it's my understanding, sir, that folks with Bakersfield City staff are actually keeping an eye on what's going on with respect to shopping carts in Fresno, because shopping carts are a problem in Bakersfield as well. So I think that's something that, we could see examined going forward, perhaps. But yes, with respect to the issue of panhandling or aggressive solicitation, there is a state penal code which talks about this. With respect to Bakersfield, of course, the aggressive solicitation ordinance has not passed yet. The city's only remotely similar ordinance is one prohibiting loitering, quote, under circumstances manifesting the purpose of engaging in drug-related activity. That's the only current Bakersfield ordinance on the books. But there is a state penal code, section of the state penal code pertaining to, pertaining to disorderly conduct, and this would make it make various types of disorderly conduct misdemeanor crimes. One section applies to, quote, anyone who accosts other persons in any public place or any place open to the public for the purpose of begging or soliciting alms. And I did indeed hear from a Bakersfield resident who was cited on this recently. And, police felt like they observed the man not acting aggressively, but said that, you know, under state penal code, the aggressive component is not necessary. And so this gentleman was actually cited under state penal code, and he was surprised to have this happen because he did not think, and of course he was correct, that Bakersfield does not yet have an aggressive solicitation or quote-unquote panhandling ordinance.
Go ahead, Clint. I was thinking about, while we talk about being compassionate in our solutions, it's important to also remember the business owners and the homeowners and that have to deal with these kinds of problems.
Absolutely. Yes, and in Bakersfield, the Downtown Business Association has been very vocal in saying, you know, we want to be compassionate, we want to work with homeless advocates, but at the same time, our members, you know, entrepreneurs in the downtown area, the city's historic, retail core, need to be able to conduct business.
You know, wanted to share the story of an insurance guy who has a State Farm office in the city of Fresno, and it's a very lush outdoor garden that he has out in front of the office, and every many mornings he has to come in, and he has people sleeping in there, and he has to get them moving along. He says they take a long time. He's got clients coming in to invest their life savings, and they're homeless sleeping on the front porch of his office as the neighborhood around his office has changed. And so I think it's also important to remember the business owner and the homeowner that have to deal with these challenges while we look for solutions, workable, enforceable, and compassionate solutions with our homeless.
Well, it's a story that's very interesting and one that we will be following as it continues, and the effort to address not only legislation regarding the homeless, but the larger problem of dealing with those living on the streets and finding them housing and services throughout Central California. Again, we'd like to thank Theo Douglas, a reporter with the Bakersfield Californian, joining us today on the phone. Theo, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Clint Olivier, who represents District 7 on the Fresno City Council, which just passed some new legislation regarding shopping carts and recycling centers. Clint, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley
Thank you
Edition.
Very much. Always a pleasure.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Should college athletes be paid? One group of athletes at Northwestern University wants to form a union. We'll talk about that with Merrick Warzowski of the Fresno Bee coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, 95% of the world's ATMs run on an operating system that Microsoft will no longer support. What might this mean for banks and an ATM user?
So you're looking at machines that will either have to be, you know, just basically taken to the dump or will have to be upgraded at great expense.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now starts this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The trend that craft beer has swept the country, and it can be found in almost any grocery store in California. One local brewery has helped spearhead the movement in Central California. FM 89 reporter Ezra David Romero visits Fresno-based Tioga Sequoia Brewing Company to hear about their latest innovation in brewing.
It's 7:45 in the morning, and Lee Morphew's workday has just begun. He's busy prepping for a day of beer making at Tioga Sequoia Brewing Company in downtown Fresno. He's Tioga Sequoia's head brewer, and he loves to create new beer infusions. Today he's taking raw wheat kernels, grinding them up, adding them to boiling water, and creating a hot soupy slurry that will eventually become 22-ounce bottles of beer.
I'm always watching the level compared to how much grain we have stacked left to determine the flow.
Tioga Sequoia is one of a growing number of local independent beer makers, also known as craft breweries. Nationwide, these small-scale producers are the hottest trend in the industry, with sales growing by 20% last year, according to the Brewers Association. And as beer drinkers set aside macro brews like Bud and Coors for something quirky and local, brewmasters like Morphew are letting their creativity run wild. His latest brew is a chocolate milk stout infused with coffee from local roaster Leo Rios at Cafe Corazon in Fresno's Tower District. Morphew calls the hybrid coffee beer Rush Hour.
Rush Hour is actually something I made almost because I wanted to drink something like that. And I came in on the weekend and kind of made 10 gallons was the first batch. And with those 10 gallons, we got so much response and desire to have that beer that we kind of got pushed into making more, and from that point we're making it on a large scale.
It's this quest for new flavors that's helping put Tioga Sequoia on the map. Rush Hour is the latest product in a line that also includes Joaquin Murrieta chili flavored beer and Sugar Pine Cocoa Vanilla Porter. That openness to experiment is what brought Lee Morphew to the company last May. In college, he studied molecular biology and worked part-time at a brewery in Denver to pay his bills. It was there he discovered that biology and beer are the perfect brew.
When I came in, it seemed like they were really, really focused on just making, their production beers. And I felt like to get people excited, to get people always wanting more Tioga stuff, we have to make something cutting edge all the time and always have people thinking, oh, what is Tioga doing next? Or they made this beer, I really want to try it.
Every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. from now through mid-spring, Tioga Sequoia's main brewery, south of Chukchansey Park, is open for tastings, growler fill-ups, and bottled beer sales.
What do you guys want to try?
It's here where the brewery's marketing manager, Michael Cruz, and I poured a glass of Rush Hour.
Let's taste it.
Yeah, cheers. You get that, huh? Yeah, it's creamy. That beer is, it's basically a milk stout. We call it a chocolate milk stout because its base beer, as if you will, has all the characteristics of chocolate. We also use lactose for the sweetening part of it.
Cruz says Tioga Sequoia is growing to meet consumer demand. The company plans to introduce other flavor-infused beers, and later this spring will open its downtown brewery to the public with a new tap room. Julia Herz is the craft beer program director of the Brewers Association and publisher for craftbeer.com. She says Tioga Sequoia's connection with local consumers is a key to the company's success.
Beer lovers in, say, Southern or Northern California have seen these breweries come of age and really not just become small businesses down the street, but small businesses and that they believe in.
But Cruz and Morphew aren't just set on getting Valley residents to drink local. Their goal is to make their beer a hit with drinkers nationally or even globally. They've already entered Rush Hour and three other beers into the World Beer Cup.
So it's kind of a big deal when you win. It's, that your beer is the best in that category for 2 years, and, it's big bragging rights.
Tioga Sequoia plans to hold a sneak preview of their new tap room and unveil their newest beer flavors at an event at the brewery on April 12th.
Did you want to try anything, or you already settled in? Did you try that yet?
Enjoying a beer in downtown Fresno, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Should college athletes get paid to play? That's a big question right now facing the entire collegiate sports world. Media products like March Madness and the College Football Bowl season bring in billions every year based on the efforts of amateur athletes. But aren't students already getting compensated in the form of a college education? There's a lot of complex issues in this debate, no doubt. But late last week, the debate became even more interesting when, for the first time ever, the National Labor Relations Board authorized one group of student-athletes to form a labor union, in this case, football players at Northwestern University. So what does this mean for students and higher education? Here to tell us more is Mark Wazowski, sports columnist with the Fresno Bee, who talks about this in his column in today's paper, The War Zone. Merrick, welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So this issue about paying student athletes is not new, but this latest decision by the NLRB certainly got everyone talking about it again, not to mention the billions that come in for March Madness, and we're just off the bowl season and all of the television money that's flooding in. What exactly does this mean? You say in your column today that there's no threat large enough to make the NCAA budge from some of its ridiculous rules as a potential union.
Well, Joe, I mean, this is kind of a culmination of things that have been building up, I think, over the last 10 or 15 years in regards to college sports. And I think it came out of left field a little bit last week. Everyone knew about this case, but I don't think people expected the ruling to go down in favor of the Northwestern players like it was. In terms of what it means, as of right now, it means a lot of confusion because, you know, there still has to be several things have to happen for a union to, scholarship football players to take place at Northwestern. They have to vote that they actually want one. I mean, there's going to be many, many appeals. They're saying this thing can go all the way to the Supreme Court. So as of right now, it just kind of poses a lot of questions, and a lot of people are asking a lot of questions about what all this means. And, you know, we could talk for hours about what all this means. I mean, you know, are college employees, are college student athletes actually employees? And if so, are those scholarships actually salaries? And, you know, that opens a whole bunch of questions of, are they covered by workman's comp then? Are they taxable? You know, is that taxable income? There's numerous questions that are going to have to be answered about this. But what I think it does is actually it kind of puts pressure on the NCAA to, you know, hey, maybe we need to negotiate something, or we need to take some measure or some action so that it doesn't come to this.
Now, the Northwestern case involves students who are seeking to organize, and their initial demands are largely in regards to health care, and these are football players with concerns about potential for concussion-related injuries, TBI, and those sorts of things. They want stronger protocols in place. In professional sports, you have player unions who advocate on behalf of their athletes and their members. In the colleges, those students largely don't have that representation. These students say they want a union to raise their profile and give them some more bargaining power with making sure that there's trained concussion specialists on every sideline. How does this fit into that sort of concern about the cost beyond just you're playing for?
Well,
it's
all part of it. I mean, if a football player suffers an injury at Northwestern, you're going to receive some immediate medical care. But what about long term? When you're gone, what if something comes back? You know, there's nothing there for them. So concussions, obviously a huge situation, a huge issue in football now. Whose interest is, these team doctors on the sideline, whose interest are they looking out for when somebody gets hurt, So they call it these players, their CAPA is the union that's called. They want, somebody independent doctor, to monitor those things on the sideline. They also would like, money set aside for college players that, decide to either go to the NFL or don't finish their career to come back and be able to finish their education. You know, there's no money set aside for that. So really, there as of this point, this union is not asking for to be paid, pay for play. They say that is a very tertiary demand that they have. And these other medical and insurance demands, are more important than that. And I believe them, I believe them. And the other thing to realize is that, we always talk about a scholarship. You got a scholarship. Well, scholarships don't meet all the needs of these student athletes. I mean, there's several $1,000 gap that has to be made up. So it's not like you say a full ride. Well, it's not really a full ride. It's a almost full ride, and you still have to make up a few $1,000.
The NC2A is such a huge business. The amount of money that schools and the overall NC2A bring in is just astronomical. You have schools who have their own television networks now and some of the larger conferences. And the power that comes with that money is very interesting. It's not just with the big sports, though. You relate this story in today's column. Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith, who makes $940,000 a year base salary, he's getting an $18,000 bonus because a Buckeyes wrestler won an NC2A title. The wrestler, he doesn't get anything.
No, he doesn't. And what you know, I mean, I could see the athletic director getting a bonus for a team championship because a lot of athletic directors do. I mean, that's a performance bonus. I mean, you'll see similar things in a CEO of a company has contract for performance bonuses. But an individual wrestler, I mean, what in goodness, you know, he had nothing to do with that. Why should he be benefiting from it? Joe, it's a symptom of where the scales have kind of tipped in college sports a little bit. You know, back in the 80s and the 70s, you could say, you know, hey, a scholarship is kind of a just meritorious reward for this stuff. But gosh, if you've, you know, I'm not talking about Fresno State here because they're in a conference that gets peanuts compared to the, you know, the Big Ten, Pac-10. But if you go to one of these schools like Nebraska and see the kind of facilities that they've built and, you know, you walk into this room and you see like a seven-story waterfall and video rooms that have, you know, fancy presentations of Heisman Trophy winners and you see this, all these fancy buildings and opulence. And I mean, this is something in the last like 10 to 15 years. So much money has been poured into colleges through these TV contracts. There's kind of an arms race to who can build the nicer buildings, who can build the fancier offices, and what does that have to do with college and university and education? So the scales have kind of gotten out of whack. So this is a way, I think, of balancing them out a little bit more.
I've heard there's some talk that the NC2A is considering, at least some of the larger conferences, of having some extra compensation, not an official payment or not an official job salary, but some sort of extra compensation for students in some revenue-generating sports. But you have the NC2A that has wildly different types of schools. A Fresno State or a CSUB is radically different than LSU or USC. And can the NC2A as an organization continue to exist or survive, at least as we know it, given this gap? And would paying college athletes perhaps even bring that potential breakup to fruition quicker?
Right. Well, the NCAA has already broken up into several different levels. And, you know, the big conferences, the Big Five, which is the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the ACC, and the SEC, they have already voted to kind of increase the kind of scholarship limit for student athletes to give them this kind of supplemental income that we've talked about. It's not going to be some huge amount of money, but a couple hundred dollars more a month basically to help make ends meet. Well, the smaller schools that can't afford this kind of thing, like the Fresno States and the Cal State Bakersfields, they've voted this down. So what's going to happen, Joe, I think, in the next couple of years is that these big schools with the big power conferences are going to break away from the Fresno States of the world and form their own division and where they can kind of do their own rules. Now, you still have Title IX implications and a lot of other things that have to be sorted out with this. You know, you're going to pay a football player, you know, a little bit more. What's going to happen to your gymnast? What's going to happen to your woman swimmer? I mean, those are issues that are going to have to all be sorted out, you know.
That's a huge issue. I was just going to ask you about that next. Fresno has a great familiarity with Title IX enforcement. The university is doing a much better job with gender equity now than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. But what does that say for that one student athlete when we're supposed to believe that all these student athletes are equal and they're student athletes, that one student athlete in a revenue-generating sport would be making extra money, and the student in a non-revenue generating sport, maybe a female student athlete, isn't getting that extra compensation. Does that even fit with our notion of the collegiate experience?
Well, first of all, Joe, the notion that, you know, a Johnny Manziel at Texas A&M and a woman swimmer are somewhat equal, I mean, that is so not true. I mean, yes, they're both student athletes at Texas A&M, and the comparison stops, you know, there. So it's kind of hard, you know, is the law going to catch up to this, or are there going to be ways to go around this law? You know, I really don't know. But, you know, that is a big question. And you know, I personally, I mean, I'm certainly in favor of Title IX and women's sports, but when you start asking, you know, we have to balance out football with, you know, women's softball and basketball, to me it starts not making a whole lot of sense, you know, and I guess that's just my personal opinion on that. So this
is definitely an issue that's in the news right now and with the NCAA. What do you think a school like a Fresno State or a CSUB would do if all of a sudden you have this new tier of college that is of college sports where student athletes are being paid in the revenue and generating sports football and men's basketball? How does that change the way these schools operate? And is this Division I sports, does that essentially become a split level?
Right. Well, if Division I football is already broken up into the FBS and FCS system. I could see a further subdivision of the FBS where the big conferences are kind of in a separate division from the smaller conferences and aren't going to and they don't already share any revenues. I don't see how things are going to change that much, Joe. You know, it's already not equal. You know, they might be in the same division now, but they're basically playing in different leagues.
But for the past 25 years, a school like Fresno State has made its mission that it wants to be one of the big boys at the table. All of a sudden, that seems increasingly unlikely in this new scenario?
It definitely does, Joe. If Fresno State would not be, as if things stand today, one of those teams that's invited to join this new conference or new division of football. And yes, the whole goal of we want to get to the BCS, make some noise on a national stage, it would be reduced, no question. And that could affect things around here. And you're right.
Well, again, we're talking about this a new issue that has just popped up again in the news late last week. Northwestern student athletes granted permission from the NC2A, not the NC2A, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, to unionize. They are still seeking to actually form that union, but they have the go-ahead to work on that. Again, we've been talking with Merrick Warzowski of the Fresno Bee. His latest column in today's paper, The War Zone, talks about this unionization issue. Merrick, thank you so much for joining us on Valley Edition today.
You're welcome, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll talk about the implementation of the new health care law and the deadline. What was the turnout like yesterday as people sought to sign up? Also, a preview of this weekend's Fresno Philharmonic concert with guest artist Wu Man, a Chinese artist who brings an instrument many of you have probably not heard to the Valley. It's called the pipa. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition.
In this symphony, the woodwinds are very, very exclusively handled. An oboe solo, these wonderful flute soli, the clarinet solos, and even the bassoon really show off in the most sensitive way.
Christoph Eschenbach conducts Bruckner's Ninth Symphony on this week's Chicago Symphony Orchestra broadcast. I'm Lisa Simeone.
Tonight at 8 on Valley Public Radio.
The first Sunday in May is Valley Public Radio's annual wine tasting at the Lester Estate in Fresno. Hi, this is Mike from Rubber Sole Bicycles in Fresno inviting you to join us Sunday, May 4th for Mastering the Art of Wine, the 30th anniversary of FM 89's signature fundraising event. Look for the His and Hers Trek 820 bicycles from Rubber Sole in the silent auction tent and see photos of them online. Tickets and details for Sunday, May 4th are available online at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. California's Health Insurance Exchange says it's received a surge of last-minute enrollments ahead of last night's midnight application deadline. Enrollment events popped up across the state as the covered California call center reported waits of more than an hour in the final days. Ben Adler reports from one such event in Sacramento.
My name is Donna, and I'm going to go ahead and walk you through our process, okay?
So what is your name?
A room full of people waited up to 45 minutes at a Sacramento Union Hall to sign up for the Covered California Healthcare Exchange on the final day of open enrollment. Union organizers called it a 17-hour enroll-a-thon.
Okay, perfect. And do you both have your Social Security cards with you?
The dozens of people in the room just before lunchtime spread across all age groups and were nearly all minorities. 26-year-old Martise Moore of Sacramento, who's currently unemployed, says he'd rather not pay for health insurance, but he figures it's better than paying a fine for not having insurance.
It's something that I've been, procrastinating to do, but, you know, it was the last day, so I had to hurry up and get in here and sign up for this Obamacare.
Not everyone at the enroll-a-thon was happy about being there. 45-year-old carpenter Anthony Gagliardo drove about 45 minutes from the Sierra foothill town of Auburn.
Generally, who I'm working with is who I have health care with, but right now I'm not working, so I had an eye injury, so right now I have no source of income. I'm waiting for my second surgery, so I have to get health care. I have no choice.
Crescencio Garcia of West Sacramento says he tried to enroll by phone but couldn't, so he came to apply in person. At 51, the unemployed pastry chef says he likes the idea of having insurance, but isn't sure how well the federal health care law will work or if he can afford the monthly premiums. And although he started his application process, he left without finding out how much his coverage will cost.
They say, you know, the system is too slow, and it's like we got a lot of people, so I make a room for another people. He's going to call me in a couple of days.
Garcia and other Californians who started their insurance applications by the midnight deadline will have until April 15th to complete them. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition. This weekend, the Fresno Philharmonic brings local audiences a truly unique concert, one that mixes sounds of East and West, featuring a soloist playing an instrument that I think it's safe to say most of our listeners have never heard before, at least in person. I'm talking about the traditional Chinese instrument, the pipa, as performed by one of its finest practitioners in the world, guest artist Wu Man. She'll be performing a piece by the Academy Award-winning composer Tan Dun, who is best known in the U.S. for his score for the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. The concert also features two all-time classics of the Western classical tradition, Beethoven's 7th and 8th symphonies, making for a concert that is truly East meets West. Joining us now on the telephone, we have that guest artist, Wu Man. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Hello, my pleasure.
We just heard a selection from your recent performance at NPR, the Tiny Desk Concert, and a solo performance on the pipa. Tell me a little more about your instrument, its history, and what it might compare to in maybe the Western tradition.
Pipa always described as a pear-shaped lute-like instrument. It's a plucking instrument. It's very much like a guitar and banjo, with a very long history. Existed in China around the 2,000 years. It's an old instrument, but originally from Central Asia, from a Persian, was introduced to China through the Silk Road trade. But already existed in China over 7 years, so now it's become very much a Chinese instrument. With the four strings and play both hands and left hands, very much like a guitar and banjo, you just push the string and the frets. And the right hand plucking, either five fingers to plucking the strings.
It's a beautiful instrument, and we're really looking forward to your performance this weekend. Again, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall in Fresno with the Fresno Philharmonic in this East Meets West concert. Tell us about the piece which you'll be performing, the Concerto for Pipa by Tan Dun. How did this piece come about? I understand it has some origins in a project that started out with the Kronos Quartet and then developed into its own concerto?
Yes. Pipa is very popular in China or in Chinese community. You know, most Chinese will know what a pipa is, what the instrument look like, and even what the repertoire of pipa will, you know, very popular in China. And this piece, originally, it's a string quartet plus pipa, so it's a quintet piece. It's called Ghost Opera, which is you mentioned with the Kronos Quartet commissioned Tan Dun which is almost 20 years ago now. Later on, composer Tandon rearranged to a pipa concerto with a string orchestra. The music, very interesting because the composer came from the area in China, which is Hunan area. And probably most of us know the Hunan spicy food. Mm-hmm. So the music, the color, quite like that. It's very different than we're going to hear Beethoven that same evening. The pipa language, also very unique, the style, very different from Western music. So the composer combined those two instruments, the strings, European classical strings, with the Chinese classical string instrument, and we put it together, and the color just beautiful. But also I want to say, in this particular piece, pipa, my role, it's like a storyteller, and kind of telling a story, and the string kind of supports this storyteller. So if you have that imagination, definitely the piece is going to be fantastic for your experience. Yes.
Is it challenging to marry these two different traditions? And just from a technical standpoint, an instrument like the pipa playing with instruments designed in the Western 12-tone mm-hmm. system, just in terms of tuning, is that challenging?
To me, actually, tuning is natural. I keep my traditional tuning, but for string player, oh, yeah. very different. The way they play, the way they slide notes, especially the left hand, and all the way they're bowing, very different from when they play Beethoven, for sure. So they have intonation and also the style, the language of the music, a Chinese language. So you will hear, and also because the composer from Hunan area, so they have a particular local dialect kind of style. So for string player, they do have different way to play. And it's actually, I think it's a challenge for them. you were surprised in this piece and require player not only play, we have to shouting. It's exciting, very exciting piece. And for the color, the combination, sort of a concerto concept, this is not a Chinese traditional concept. For my instrument, the concerto, sort of that kind of a format, it's quite new idea. It's quite new kind of a revolution. We just started later 80s that exists a sort of concerto piece. So that way it is challenging for us. But also for my instrument, the designs, not for the big hall. It's very intimacy kind of instrument. It sounds very elegant. So in the hall, we play with a big orchestra. I do have to use amplification a little bit, touch the sound, so the audience be able to hear more details of the instrument.
Well, it's very exciting, and we're looking forward to this concert coming up again this weekend with the Fresno Philharmonic and guest artist Wu Man. She is one of the leading practitioners of the pipa and is bringing this instrument to Western audiences across the world. She's performing the Concerto for Pipa by composer Tan Dun this weekend with the Philharmonic in this East Meets West concert that also features two symphonies by Beethoven. The concert again Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall in Fresno. It's one of the Masterworks Series concert. It's part of the Philharmonic 60th anniversary season, and we are definitely looking forward to it and hope to have you in our studio later this week and maybe even have a little in-studio demonstration of the pipa. So, Wu Man, again, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to that.
Great. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or follow us on Twitter. We're at KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.